Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
I'm your radio, radio show. I'm your radio, radio show.
Hello and welcome to the Niler 9 podcast. I am Niler 9 and with me, of course, is Andrea Cleary. How are you, Andrea?
Hello, everyone.
How are we doing?
No gap this time.
Nice.
I was straight
When you're holding the mic, you're just much more with it and forthright. You're ready for it.
I do feel it
Q&A style.
Inject some confidence into me. My mic stand is floppy, I think is the word I can use for it. It's gone floppy. So I'm holding the mic and I am feeling a bit
loosey goosey.
Yeah, like the PlayStation game Buzz that I play with my father every time I go out to his house.
don't know what that is.
Remembers that or knows it? That's for you.
Well, welcome along to the 909 podcast, whether you're holding a microphone, buzzing to be listening or buzzing to be playing Buzz. You are very welcome along because this week is a episode deep dive into an album that we are actually presenting next week as a listening party. Now, as time of writing, as what keeps happening is these tickets go really fast and therefore you can no longer buy a ticket for this event. We do a party, a listening party called Listen Closely in the Big Romance on the last Wednesday of every month. So far, we've done albums like Laurie Anderson's Big Science. We've done Fortet Rounds, Sufjan Stevens' Illinois, Mad Villain, Mad Villainy. And we generally do a podcast alongside that, which is about the album, a kind of a time in which to luxuriate in a single album and talk about where it came from, the time it was made, how it was made, and its recording and its impact on us. So, as I said, we've got another one next week, and that album is a 1994 trip-hop classic, an album from Portishead called Dummy. As the opening bars of Mr. Ons from Portishead's album Dummy, which is our chosen deep dive album this month. It is the debut album from the Bristol trio of Jeff Barrow, Beth Gibbons and Adrian Utley. An album considered a hip-hop classic that paired hip-hop, jazz, electronic textures with Beth Gibbons' spine-tingling voice, some twangy tremolo guitars that would more likely be heard in a spy movie or a James Bond movie. So at the time of release, Portishead Dummy came out in the summer that Blur's Parklife came out, and Oasis's Definitely Maybe. And definitely, although it isn't as popular as those albums, or it wasn't as popular then, it was quite popular for its time and for the kind of vibe it was. So by the winter of 1994, Dummy was actually quite popular. In January, it went to number 3 in the charts behind Celine Dion and The Beautiful South. And the two big singles from it, Sour Times and Glory Box, became top 15 singles. Here's a bit of the famous Glory Box.
I'm so tired of playing with this bow and arrow. Gonna give my heart away, leave it to the other girls to play. For I've been a temptress too long.
So that was Glory Box, one of the big singles from Dummy, and a big song for the band, and a big song of 1994-95. And Dummy itself was, when it was released in August 1994, it kind of helped cement the reputation of Bristol, the city, as a capital of a genre called trip hop, which was, you know, really like it was constructed by the media as well. But there were things happening in Bristol at that time. We're talking about the likes of Massive Attack and Tricky were especially coming out of Bristol, along with Portishead. Portishead actually get their name from a seaside town that's slightly outside Bristol. They just once were called, I think where they actually got their name really was that somebody just said, oh, the lads from Portishead are there, and they didn't have a name. I think it was in a newspaper or something, a Music Weekly, and said that Nina Cherry's working with guys from Portishead, thinking that was the band name. That's what they ended up being called, because they didn't have a name then, and that's where they got the name Portishead. So there you go. It is an actual place. But yeah, so Bristol, the Bristol sound was something that was quite prominent at that time, and Portishead's music and arrival with Dummy certainly helped add to that Bristol sound. Now, there's a lot of actually crossover in terms of Portishead and Massive Attack as well, because they actually did work out of the same kind of studio and stuff. So first of all, here's something that I had never heard of before, and I'm going to share this now. This is a Massive Attack's first single. So they had a production duo called Smith and Mighty, who are kind of the precursors to a lot of this Bristol sound. And they had a first single called Annie Love, which I don't think I'd ever heard before till today. So I'm going to play it now as a curio. Here we go. Anyway, I thought that was interesting. That was Massive Attack's first ever single, which was their first ever 12-inch release in 1988. So, yeah, I'd never heard that before. You familiar with that before?
No.
So I was like, oh, wow, didn't know that they even existed.
I'm a fan of Massive Attack and I'm a fan of Portishead, but this whole, which is why I'm really happy that you're taking the lead on this episode, this whole world, I find very confusing, all the crossovers and who's influencing who, so... You're setting the record straight for me. I'm very much just like aware of the albums, you know.
Sure. Well, I mean, I guess that's where Massive Attack started. They were like the Wild Bunch, which, you know, DJs and rappers and stuff. And then they became Massive Attack, and Smith and Mighty were certainly involved in the early days of their production and stuff like that, as we heard there in that single, Annie Love. And then I mentioned the likes of Tricky as well. I mean, and like a lot of what we're talking about here is the term trip hop, right? So what is trip hop? Its common aesthetics include a bass heavy drum beat or break beat that often sounds like it's dragging a little bit or slowing down. It's kind of like slower hip hop beats and the kind of things that were very popular at that time, like with Tribe Called Quest and DJ Premier and stuff like that. So it kind of slowing those drums down and giving it kind of an extra trippy element became that kind of trip hop sound. And I'll play some examples now in a sec. Female vocals were often a characteristic of trip-hop music, although that's not exclusive, but certainly there was more, considering at the time we're talking about 1994-95, a lot more female front women singers in bands in trip-hop kind of acts than most other genres at that time. And the other things that you would obviously hear a lot more of, I think there was a lot of mining from the past, a lot of sampling, stuff like that. But there were also a lot of like jazzy kind of instrumentation. We had the likes of like Rhodes pianos, theremins were very popular in it, mellotrons, saxophones, trumpets, flutes, all those kind of things, but mostly like sampled. So it's kind of R&B, jazz, rock, spy movie soundtracks, all that kind of stuff, John Barry, all that kind of vibe. So here is some very brief examples of some music that you might consider trip-hop. Like DJ Shadow's early work would have been considered trip-hop. Here's a track from Preemptive Strike, his early album called Influx, which you can hear this kind of breakbeat style. Yeah, that kind of scratching is a big part of the Portishead sound as well. So we get into that in a bit. Here's an example of a song from Cold Cut called Eine Kleine Head Music.
The last survivor.
And a lot of the music that was released around that time on labels like Ninja Tune was considered like trip hop. It's kind of like instrumental, trippy, psychedelic hip hop kind of instrumentals. And I mentioned Massive Attack there as well. Here's a fine example on Blue Lines, their famous debut, a brilliant debut. Here we go. This is how's that kind of trip hop vibe to it.
It seems as such beautiful thoughts, whereas I dream too much. Even if I told you, you still would not know me. Tricky never does. Adrian mostly gets lonely. How we live in his existence, just be it. English upbringing, background Caribbean.
It's the way that we ability, sharing a soliloquy. Pick up the broken thread for flexibility. Mickey, I'm a 3DZ. Sauna wing glaze, ain't no sunshine in my life, because the way I deal is hazy. Different day to day.
And yes, I chose a song there which Tricky does feature on Massive Attack, because in his own work on, say, Max and Key, which is his album from 1995, really, really brilliant album, you can hear a lot of that kind of trip hop vibe as well. This is Aftermath. So it's that kind of spacious breakbeaty drum, that kind of almost blunted jazz kind of style. Obviously, you can hear this in an album we talked about recently with its creator, David Holmes, Let's Get Killed. You can hear this on an example, a track like Rodney Yates. Probably leaning more into the jazz vibe there. But then there was bands that came after Portishead, like Sneaker Pimps, which were more kind of a poppy version of it. This is their big hit, Six Underground. And then there was more the alternative, kind of more experimental stuff that didn't come out of the UK really, but was more, I think the band Lamb, they were from Manchester as well, so not too far away, but this kind of vibe, Lusty, this is from their album Lamb. So yeah, the kind of like tinkling, kind of like heavy drums is kind of a lot of what goes on in trip hop. And Portishead really tick all those boxes in terms of their music. And what I found really interesting reading up about this album, I love Portishead. They have three albums and this is their first one. They were few and far between in terms of releases, like the 1994's Dummy and 1997's self-titled, and then 2008's third album, which was released. That was their last thing they did other than an ABBA cover called SOS. That was one of the most recent things they did. But Dummy is the first. It came first. And as I said, it kind of helps coagulate all that kind of trip hop vibe into one single album, became way more popular than the band ever thought. I'm going to read a bit about John Bush for All Music said it is a natural synthesis of claustrophobic spy soundtracks, dark breakbeats inspired by Jeff Barrow's love of hip hop and a vocalist Bette Gibbons in the classical confessional songwriter, singer-songwriter mold. The chilling atmospheres conjured by Adrian Utley's excellent guitar work and Barrow's turntables and keyboards provide the perfect foil for Gibbons, who balance sultriness and melancholia in equal measure. Where previous acts like Massive Attack had attracted dance heads in the main, Portishead crossed over to an American alternative audience, connecting with a legion of angst-ridden indie fans as well. Better than any album before it, Dummy merged the pinpoint precise productions of the dance world with pop hallmarks like great songwriting and excellent vocal performances. Philip Sherburne, in his more recent Pitchfork review, I think it was from 2007 or 8, says, Portishead's 1994 debut is a masterwork of downbeat and desperation. They invented their own kind of virtuosity, one that encompassed musicianship, technology, and aura. In the UK, a dummy isn't just a mannequin or an idiot, it's also what Americans would call a pacifier. Savour the irony in the title of Portishead's debut album. The album may suggest coziness, sonic swaddling, the gentle soundtrack to a raver's come down, and in 1994, ravers were plenty familiar with pacifiers. But Dummy doesn't coddle, it unsettles. It tastes not like warm milk, but coppery and bitter like blood. Despite its 2+ decades spent soundtracking makeout sessions, it cradles a terrible loneliness in its heart. Despite its reputation as dinner party music, it is straight up discomfort food. Curl up and die music, head under the covers music. It's dark, dank and quintessentially Bristol, mingling a chilling harbour fog with the resin of 1,000 spliffs left to burn down in a haze. There isn't a sound or syllable out of place on Dummy. For 50 minutes, the album sustains a single all-enveloping mood. Its tracklist is a 10-sided die where every roll comes up some variation of despair. Their sense of contrast is particularly noticeable in the album's rhythms. Barrow's lickety-split vinyl scratching helps counterbalance uniformly sluggish tempos, but the real action is in the breakbeats. In Mr. Ons, which is the song we played to start, the loop snare rolls around like a steel trap, snapping shut and being pried back open in quick succession. The Sour Times beat resembles James Brown's iconic funky drummer break, but transposed for a planet with only half of Earth's gravity. Wandering Star and Numb, on the other hand, push forward as though running underwater, every beat a struggle against an overwhelming force. Track after track, the album toggles between crisp steppers and deadweight friction, between ping-pong and ricochets and Sisyphus' Last Stand. So it's been also called like pseudo-cabaret kind of pop songs in with these kind of hip-hop beats. But the actual background to the album was quite surprising to me. I didn't know about this until I got into it just really this week. So how they met is really interesting. So I'm going to play a bit of audio here from their KEXP interview, which is a 2.5-hour interview that they did in 2019 on the 25th anniversary, I believe, of the album. Like, they were unusual, as they, Portishead weren't a band in a traditional sense. They didn't play live prior to making this album, and it's only when they became popular that they figured out how to play these songs live. They didn't approach music making like a band. It was more like a cut and paste scientific experiment. Uniquely as well, I mean, it was quite a different range of people and age groups in the band. Jeff Barrow at the time was 22, a hip-hop fan obsessed with turntables, and Adrian Utley was a 37-year-old jazz guitarist who was looking for something different. And then Bette Gibbons is a 29-year-old singer at the time who grew up on a farm and had never really sung outside of her bedroom. So how did they meet? Was during an enterprise allowance course in February 1991. Here is them explaining this.
In the UK, that you could do a year being unemployed and the government would pay you the same amount of money you would get as being unemployed, but you could set up a business. So the idea was, it was, you know, I was going to set up a music production company. So, but we had to go for this kind of one day where you sit around and you learn about the facts of how to do it.
Personal Humiliation Day, I think it's called.
Personal Humiliation Day through the government, yeah. And it was really awkward. Sat on it around this big kind of table in this hotel in Clifton, and there was a mobile hairdresser. There was a guy who wanted to sell chocolates out the back of his van. You know, like a sheep shearer, and then Beth, she kind of said, "I want to." She was working and she wanted to quit and just do singing as a career, and she wanted to concentrate on a songwriting and so on. And instantly, we just kind of went. It was that same thing. It was like, oh, she's a professional singer, and she's looking at us going, oh, they're like a music production company. This is amazing. Like, we could have been, well, absolutely terrible, you know, but we were just like, right, let's work together, you know.
That's brilliant.
And she...
That's just a rare example of people meeting in fate and it actually working out, and very much like underscores the idea that these people maybe wouldn't have met before. Certainly Bette Gibbons and the rest of the band may not have met before. So how this album came about was they started recording their first ideas for songs in Nina Cherry's kitchen in London, because Jeff Barrow was hired by her husband Cameron McVeigh to work on her second album, Homebrew, from 1992. A year earlier, Barrow had worked as an errand boy and tape operation up in Bristol's Coach House Studios in 1991 while Blue Lines by Massive Attack was being made. So he kind of felt some of that kind of trip hop vibe and could understand where it was coming from. He was excited by it. As I said, he was really into the turntables and stuff like that. The first song they made was, they actually met at Coach House Studios, Adrian Nutley and Jeff Barrow originally. And they record their first track, It Could Be Sweet, which does feature on the album in instrumental form. This is when they made it without Bette Gibbons. Utley said, I'd got a sampler and I was trying to learn how to do all this stuff. I was really interested in it and it was my complete passion. I've played guitar and other things since I was 15. And for a very brief time in my life, I kind of fell out in love with guitar and was really obsessed with hip hop. I didn't know about the history of it. I learned that from Jeff and Andy Smith, who's a DJ, later. But for me, it was super exciting to hear what Jeff was doing upstairs. Barrow taught Utley sampling while Utley introduced the band to unusual sounds such as a cymbalom. Do you ever hear of a cymbalom? It's an elaborate stringed instrument of the dulcer family. And theremins, which led to this kind of amalgamation of different kind of ideas. And they realized they could make their own samples not found on other records, while also they did obviously sample on this record as well. So, I mean, when they met Bette, she would come up, she was older and she had a management company, I think, as well. So it was obvious that like she was a grown up is what they're saying, and a songwriter, very unlike the people that they'd worked with before. And all of a sudden, something happened. It was seriously good, and her voice was incredible. Now, how they actually made the music, which is really interesting to me, is that they would use techniques like turntableless techniques like sample and scratching and loop making, and using samplers and stuff like that, as heard on the record. But the record was made in a much more esoteric way. Of course, none of this was made digitally at the time. So they say, Barrow says, even though we were making our own records, we had to make stuff that actually sounded like it was taken from full records and then sample that, as if we had made it too. So what they actually did is they would sample music from other records, but they also recorded their own original music, which was then recorded onto vinyl dub plates, which, you know, it's expensive enough process, before manipulating them on records decks to sample them. In order to create a vintage sound, Barrow said that they distressed the vinyl records that they had recorded by putting them on the studio floor and walking across them and using them like skateboards. They'd also recorded some of the drums and stuff through a broken amplifier. Utley says, we were really obsessed with the tiny minutiae. If you sample a record, there's probably something hanging over from the bar before, like a bit of reverb off the voice, which gives a tonality to the drum break. There might be somebody doing tiny chops in it, muffled on an organ. You're not really aware of them, but if they're not there, it makes a sound that's super clean. We were always into kind of muddying the water a bit and giving it some atmosphere. Just stuff you wouldn't really hear, but you feel, says Barrow. It's the air around the thing, he told The Wire in an interview about this. What we were trying to do is create this air, this atmosphere. It's the stuff that's in between the hi-hat and the snare that you can't hear. But if it wasn't there, you would notice it. It would be wrong. Now, this is something that we can identify as a term called hauntology in a way. Hauntology is the sampling of older spectral sounds to evoke kind of deeper cultural memories, but also in sampling music that has a load of energy and older recorded energy in it, you're kind of bringing something that intangible with you into the present. You know what I mean? So hauntology is what that's called. So they had this thing going on, and Barrow said, but then we had Bette. That made a massive difference. You had people like DJ Shadow, and there was maybe never a focus point, deep songwriting and personal feeling. Bette brought soul to the record. They had a session player called Clive Deemer who'd played drums on the record, which there are some brilliant drums on this as well. He had worked with acts like Radiohead, Jeff Beck, Alison Moye, Susie Sue, Ronnie Size, Hawkwind, Robert Plant and Represent. And there was a big hip-hop influence on this record as well. I mean, Barrow says, I mean, we were into this thing that we called hip-hop tuning. This kind of follows on from that kind of hauntology aspect of it. Hip-hop tuning, which is when people like New York hip-hop producers really inspired us. They would take a sample from a Shostovich and have a big orchestral thing, and then they would take a beat from James Brown. Then it would take a horn riff from Fred Wesley or Miles Davis, but they had drums that were already in it, and they had bottom end in it. So they would try and craft these scenes together. Then there would be notes that wouldn't actually fit, but it kind of works if you listen to it on the far side. I was obsessed with them at the time, Utley says. It was kind of this new tonality, really. It was kind of two things forced together. Why is that working? What, because they're actually in different keys. Didn't matter anymore because we were in this new world. It doesn't matter that one's slightly sharp of the other one or is actually in a different key. If it sounds cool, that's all you need to know. And as I mentioned with spy films, were a big inspiration on this album. References, I include this, like we said, Mr. Ons comes from Thunderbirds. And the references include like John Barry's James Bond theme, the music of Thunderbirds, which was composed by Barry Gray, sci-fi soundtracks like The Day the Earth Stood Still. And then Sour Times itself actually features a sample of Lalo Schifrin's music for Mission Impossible. So there is a lot of that there as well. So really, I mean, it was surprising in a lot of ways that the album really took off, but it had a really, really amazing reaction at the time. You know, it helped popularize trip hop. It won the 1995 Mercury Prize. Who were also nominated that year? Would you have any guesses about who might be nominated in 1995?
95. Well, you said that Definitely Maybe was released that year. So, Oasis?
Yes, Oasis, Definitely and Maybe. Tricky, Max and K.
Oh.
PJ Harvey Used to Bring You My Love was also nominated that year. So Dummy won.
Big year.
And I think what does help in all of this as well at the time is that because of her background, Bette Gibbons never really gave any interviews, which only kind of enhanced the enigmatic idea of who she was. She didn't explain herself. And in any interview I've read with Adrian Utley and Jeff Barrow since about the album, and there was a number of them in 2019 on the 25th anniversary, they kind of are at pains to point out that they don't want to ever speak for her lyrics or what she represents or what they or what she's talking about.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the tracks, the more famous tracks maybe. I'll take some examples here. I've got some bits here to play. So let's play a bit of Sour Times here. I mentioned a sample that features on that song. It's The Danube Incident by Lalo Schifrin. This is it. And of course, that song, Sour Times, is one of the big singles from the record. But let's talk a little bit about the song Numb. Utley says, it sounds so heavy when we first did it. I remember being really into it and taking it on to cassette to a session I did with the singer out of Free, Paul Rogers and Jeff Beck. And they super did not get it. They said that the snare drum sounds like a tin can. I was like, yeah, wicked. It does. So this is what that sounds like. This is
wicked.
Numb. Never so lost.
Cause you're trying.
from the album Dummy, of course. And then Rhodes, Barrow says, it's actually a bit of a fan favourite, I think. I don't know if it was a single, but definitely gets a big reaction when they play it live. Let's play it here and we'll come back and just discuss it briefly here.
This moment, how can it feel this wrong?
Now, the band say this was kind of based on when the little girl gets shot in Assault on Precinct 13, the film, by the ice cream van. And there's this team that goes with it. It's a Fender Rhodes keyboard and it's really wicked. There's that word again. Utley says that's John Carpenter. He was like super switched on to that emotion and not just musicality. All his music was made because he was a director first. There's something about that. It's perfectly pitched in terms of emotion. It's kind of sad, but it's not like throw your guts up when it is something we've always tried to avoid. It's got filmic sounds that Barrow, if you listen to a lot of these kind of late 60s and 70s soundtracks, there is emotion, but it's not hidden. It's direct to the vein. So yeah, that was Rhodes. The next track I wanted to play briefly is Biscuit, which is the second last track on the album. And there's kind of a unique sample of a 1950s track on this, and I will see if we can hear it now. Going to hear that haunted sample in the background. This is from a song called from Johnny Ray from the 50s called I'll Never Fall in Love Again. Really slowed down. Here's what the original sounds like.
I'll never ever fall. I'll never fall in love again.
And of course, the big sample and a song which has actually been resampled as a result of this many, many times is Glory Box, which of course sounds like this. And of course, the original sample is Isaac Hayes, which is Ike's Rap 2. You can hear it here.
You're the only one that can straighten it. You see, love, I can't sleep. I can't even eat. Don't go anywhere anymore.
It is a song that had never really been sampled before, but became kind of through this and through their kind of American connection, a very obvious kind of a sample cornerstone. I remember that our American artist Alicia Cara in, I think probably 2012 or something, broke through, 2015, broke through with that track used as its backing. So it still sounds great today. And I think that's the thing about this album, having spent the last week or so listening to it on and off, it is really, really special. It's really, really unique. It's something that you don't really hear an awful lot. It still has its own unique, that kind of loping drums, the kind of dank atmosphere, but also like it's melancholic, but also I think it's just so beautiful as well. There's so many like gorgeous, beautiful bits of music production and sonics and vocals here that just really keep you coming back. And that's why I think it still stands the test of time, which is why we'll be doing it next week and playing it on the Big Romance speakers as well. Just really, really, really great. And I mentioned there that like that song became especially kind of misinterpreted by a lot of people as like this sexy song, right? This kind of like sexy cinematic song. And in an interview with Rolling Stone in 2019, Barrow said, talks about this. He says, the song, how the songs from Domi ended up in a lot of movies. Barrow says, terrible movies, yes. But the thing is that we never really want to work with unethical brands. We all have had a good, fairly good living out of music. We don't need to use a fashion company or an oil company or a petrol company or whatever they, that basically are actively crushing poor people on the planet to use our music to it. So we had a fairly strong vibe about that. We've basically turned down tens of millions of pounds, I think. Someone's got to say no at some point, and a lot of people don't. But when it came to films, we had a bit of an open policy. As long as they're not trying to make Bette out to be singing some kind of sexy song, which actually, he said, used to always happen with Glory Box. There was always some kind of producer saying, yeah, we want to use Glory Box over the scene. And they'd ask, is it a sex scene? And they would go, yeah, it's really sexy. And we're like, no, thanks. Oatley says, I think we've probably turned down 95% of the things that people have asked us to do. A few have slipped through the net without us realizing, actually. I saw a Nicolas Cage film called Lord of War. And I was in the cinema watching it. And there's basically a sex scene. And it was my guitar solo off Glory Box. My girlfriend looked around at me and said, did you clear this? And I went, I don't think so. And I jumped out and ran out and rang our manager. And she said, yeah, you cleared it. That slip passes without even realizing what the hell we'd done. The interviewer says, people seem to like having sex to this record. Barrow says, I couldn't tell you because I never have.
I think, like, look, you mightn't have written it to be a sexy song. And it mightn't be, in your eyes, a sexy song. But we've all decided that this is a sexy song and a sexy album, and there's nothing you can do about it. Like,
clearly.
Sorry, guys, but this is.
As long as you don't read the lyrics, you know, it's like, don't read the lyrics. For sure, nobody.
You're not reading the lyrics. You're too busy having sex.
Yeah, yeah.
Who's reading the lyrics?
Well, there's a lot of yearning in that song. Give me a reason to love you. Give me a reason to be a woman. Yeah. I just want to be a woman. Yeah, yeah. I mean,
come on.
Yeah, it's all there. I mean, but Jeff Barrow, notoriously a bit of a crank, I think. Follow him on. I don't know if he's still on Twitter now, but he's obviously in the band Beak as well.
What's he cranky about?
He's cranky about everything. He's cranky about the music industry. He's often giving out about things. There was an interview where they were giving out about Niels Fram and how he switches his scarf to show he's really important and really talented. So they like to take the piss, but they've done really well for themselves. Bette Gibbons is going to release a debut solo album in May.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It's called Lives Outgrown on Domino Records. So Barrows is still in that band Beak and away, like, he's still doing stuff a lot. I think his name pops up every now and again. He was doing stuff with a rap group called Quakers like about 10, 15 years ago. I think most recently I feel like he has a label, which is it that band Benefits maybe? I feel like it is. Yeah, Invada. Yeah, yeah. So yeah. Anyway, really good band, Benefits. Check them out. They're good. And Utti continues to perform as a session guitarist. And, you know, maybe it's not outside the realms of possibility that they'll come back and do more stuff together. So who knows? Because, I mean, I saw them twice live. You ever seen Portishead live? Oh my God, no. They are so good.
I've seen Massive Attack.
Yeah.
Which are a different band. But, you know.
Era.
But I haven't seen Portishead.
Yeah. No. Obviously, they did a number of shows around the third album in 2008. I remember seeing them in Primavera and also at Electric Picnic. And, you know, the song Machine Gun, which just is pretty incredible beginning even. I'm just going to play this for a second just to hear the very start and how... Hearing this in the nighttime air is pretty incredible. You know, they made three brilliant albums. Brilliant, brilliant albums. Like, really, really amazing albums. Like, third, I almost would put them all pretty much on the same pegging in terms of, like I like them all pretty much equally. I love their songs on the self-titled second album from 1997, like Cowboys All Mine, which really are like some of the best work they've ever done and really stand out. And then, of course, this year they'd released a 25 Roseland NYC live at their kind of live kind of video thing. I don't know what it was recorded for, but I bought that album on record recently. It is incredible. It kind of shows you what they did for the first two albums. A lot of it features the second album, but there are parts of it that feature live recordings, really beautiful with an orchestra as well. Here's a bit of how Sour Times sounds in that kind of live arena. Yeah. So again, very different, but they've really mastered that kind of big band sound on their kind of live shows as well. So yeah, so that's a lot to do with Portishead Dummy. The cover of the record, actually, as an aside, comes from a short film that they made just before they got signed to Go Records. It's a still image of Bette Gibbons taken from that short film, To Kill a Dead Man, something that they created and create a soundtrack for. So they're very much like, film is hugely part of all of this, you know, their film and cinema is hugely part of the Portishead DNA. Because they made one themselves, and then, funny, they get used a lot, whether they want to or not. So, that is Portishead's Dummy, from my perspective, in terms of the deep dive. Loads to love there, and still remains one of, probably appreciated even more now after discussing it. Do you?
I look forward to hearing it next week.
Yeah, I think this is going to sound really good on those speakers. So.
I was really late to this album. I bought it on the advice of a friend who was with me on like one of the record store days. There was a record store day release of it, and they said you'd really like this album. And then I got home and I realized that I knew a lot of the songs on it, but I didn't really kind of realize that it was, that the album itself was so kind of strong, and that it was a debut album as well. So I have it downstairs. It's very nice.
Yeah.
Very nice, like, well put together little release. And yeah, I really look forward to hearing it next week. I think it's we've said this about all the albums, but it's like the perfect album to hear on those like really nice speakers. And yeah, look forward to welcoming people in to listen to it with us in our
temporary living room. Sold out. Like, I guess the thing about these events is it's a small room. It's the back of the Big Romance. So, you know, it's still on a Wednesday night because it's generally a quieter night. You know, sometimes we have no shows, so, you know, you can come down, but we kind of try and prioritize people who, you know, will have a seat and sit down and then kind of experience the album with their eyes closed, maybe, or just whatever way you want to. But it's just kind of try and give everyone a space to be there and enjoy the full sound. So it is.
Yeah. There is a wait list as well if you want to.
Yeah. But look, I mean, you can always keep an eye out. Anyway, we'll be doing these the last Wednesday.
Stand on the other side of the curtain in the Big Romance.
It is possible. You can do that. All right, well, that's it from our podcast this week. And thank you for the feedback we got last week, on which was kind of a random grab bag of a bit of everything. And obviously a lot happened with the South by Southwest stuff since then. I did have to interject to the podcast last week to discuss, just explain how much it all had blown up in terms of the Irish bands not playing South by Southwest and cancelling because of the super sponsor being the US Army. It was supremely interesting week for all that kind of stuff as well. And we also mentioned James Blake weighing in on streaming being broken. Have you seen what he's announced?
No, his own streaming platform.
He's announced his own subscription service, essentially. And you're like, lads, come on. It's called Vault. It'll be like, this is where you can get all my unreleased tracks from a fiver a month kind of thing. And then people are just like, another subscription service? So he wants this to be like artists who can put up their kind of demos and stuff they're happy to share with the world to people, that their fans. So you pay for a Vault subscription from a fiver a month, and people are just like, hey, can somebody tell James Blake about Bandcamp, please? Because he's like, I'm gonna solve this. Look, streaming is broken, but, you know, I mean, I don't know if adding another subscription service to that is quite the way to go, but anyway, I guess he's trying. Fair play to him.
I suspect we will have a Beyonce episode within the next couple of weeks.
Oh, do we have to?
do we have to? Excuse me.
Sorry.
Yes. Yes, we do. Yeah. Cowboy Carter comes out next week, I think. So we'll figure out our schedule. But I have had a couple of DMs from people asking, are we going to talk? Well, asking, am I going to talk about it? And the answer is,
one way or another.
Yes.
It's a country album, right? So
it's a country album.
I'm definitely not going to be into this, but we'll see.
Niall.
Well, I'm just saying, I'm just being truthful. That's what you want from me, right? Truth.
I don't know. I want you to get on the vibe train. That's what I want.
There's plenty of people on the Cowboy Carter vibe train.
Anyway, we will I love, see you. I love. When
I
lo- see
just
yous.
Before we go, I love what C. Matt said on the red carpet about her music. It's country without D.O.
She did say
so
that.
So hopefully we get a bit of that sass. Anyway, that's it from us this week. If you like what you hear,
we'll see you next week.
Please think about joining the Patreon subscription, patreon.com/909. It is how we make a living in a lot of ways. It is, we have a sponsorship on the website, but in terms of covering the costs of paying people and doing the things that we're doing, consider supporting your local music platform, your music podcast platform as well. So that's patreon.com/909. There's Discord access. Had a nice Paddy's Day with some of the Discord crew in the Circular with Lumo. Yeah, Lumo is coming up as well. We're going to be doing Lumo on April 6th in the Workman Cellar. So that'll be the first time we're kind of moving out of our old home, which was Tengu, and then going to the Workman Cellar for April and May. So we're going to be moving Lumo around a bit this year. So that's April 6th. Same night as Flight of Gapes, I think, in the Olympia. So could be an after party. Who knows? But anyway, that's April 6th. Lumo's on then. If you're coming down for Portishead Dummy, we'll see you then. And thank you, Andrea.
You sure will. Thank you, Niall.
Bye, listener. Bye.
Bye, listener.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.